KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's 10:06.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. It wasn't really close. Seattle voters chose incumbent Mike McGinn and State Senator Ed Murray as their top two candidates, the men who will face off in the November general election for mayor of Seattle. Was it really a surprise? Our panel of journalists is with us once again. Erica C. Barnett, news editor at Publicola at Seattle Met, is here. Nice to have you. Perfect person to talk about elections. Knute Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com, and C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News. And before we get to really, there were sort of two big top stories. Before we talk about the election, C.R., yesterday I was interested to read the news. You talked to 8th District Congressional Representative Dave Reichert, who I'm not sure if announced is the right word, but said to you his quest for higher office.
Yeah, didn't quite announce, but I did ask him, listen, what's your political future? You know, you've been talked about as a guy that wants to run for statewide office, be that governor or senator. You know, where are you at on that? And he said, well, I'm thinking about it. I'm considering it. He said Jay Inslee is not doing too well, and he's going to keep his eye on him. That was sort of his word. So it's not the first time he's kind of flirted with him before either of those two are up. So there's a lot of time here. But with Rob McKenna out of politics, Dave Reichert really is the sort of lead Republican in the state right now. He is the guy that will be thought of as these big races come up.
And so yesterday, the other Reichert news was that he said he was going to break with the Republican hierarchy and support a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. And after hearing about what he said to you, I wondered, is this a canny political move? Or is this something he holds deep in his heart? Did you talk to him about it?
We talked a little about immigration, yes. I mean, his district actually, you know, represents a lot of immigrant workers. I mean, there's a lot,
yes,
it goes
it
all the way
now
over to what, East Wenatchee. So he's getting a lot of, you know, pressure, if you will. I mean, the business community wants immigration reform. And obviously he's, you know, been close to that business community in the past. So I think it's kind of a natural situation to where what he represents and the district he's in now, whether it's also an attempt to kind of be in play for 2016. I mean, listen, you probably have to be on the immigration reform side of this debate if you have a chance in a statewide election in Washington.
But he's one of 20-something Republican congressional representatives who've actually said, yeah, I think this is the right way to go. That's not very many.
It's not very many. And to be clear, he is not in favor of the Senate plan as it is written. So he wouldn't just endorse that. I mean, he wants to, you know, he did talk about the sort of piecemeal approach, which is kind of what the House is going to do under the leadership of John Boehner. They're going to take some of those pieces one by one. And he seems to kind of be on board that. But listen, he's broken, if you will, with the sort of Republican establishment who hasn't wanted this, where he's willing to really look at it.
Positions him well in a blue state for statewide office, at the very least. Okay, so that's Dave Reichert. We'll put him aside. Some amount of voters, and last I heard it was about 25% of registered voters, sent in their ballots by Wednesday, I guess, so that they could be counted. There was a little bit of questioning on Monday and even Tuesday about what the mayoral outcome might be, but there was no surprise. You know, Erica, I'm looking at you because election nerd on Publicola was like, ha-ha, I got it right.
Well, election nerd might be more than one person.
Yes, you all were crowing over there.
I was not crowing because I thought it was going to be Steinbrück, because I was actually trusting the tracking polls, which said that McGinn might actually come in third and possibly even fourth. And those tracking polls were just dead wrong. And I think the only people who were really still questioning on Tuesday or Wednesday were in the Steinbrück camp. I mean, I think they were still holding out some kind of last little bit of desperate hope that it wouldn't be what everybody kind of predicted.
Well, we talked to Peter Steinbrück just after 9 on Wednesday morning, and he said perhaps on Tuesday night he was holding out hope, but by Wednesday morning he'd slept on it. That was a 10 percentage point gap that he would have had to overcome in absentee, or not absentee, but late ballots, or what do we call them now when they kind
late
of
ballots.
Later ballots. And they're starting to roll in, and things haven't really changed, have they?
Well, actually, McGinn's numbers, I mean, election night, it was 27% McGinn, 30% Murray. McGinn actually has kind of won, actually, in the latest count. So he hasn't overtaken Murray in sort of the overall total, but he's now at about 28.5%, something like that.
And Murray's staying at
Murray's
30?
Basically staying at about 30. So the race has tightened, but, you know, the same story of election night is now, which is two clear winners through the primary. It's a, you know, it's kind of a very narrow race now.
Although it's pretty hard to interpret a 28% incumbent mayor at 28% as a win.
But he had eight opponents. That's a lot of people to split the rest of the vote.
It's true, but, you know, a sitting mayor generally has about 100% name recognition. So people know what they think of McGinn. I mean, I do think that he will get some of, you know, some percent, obviously, some significant percentage of the remaining votes. But, I mean, that's still a terrible number for a sitting mayor to have to make up.
Now, Canute would point out from his historical perspective that how many of the last sitting mayors lost in the primary?
Well, the two most recent sitting mayors before McGinn both did lose in primaries while they were incumbents. And so I think people were very cautious about whether McGinn would make it through or not. And it really played out in his favor because you had, you know, divided opposition in terms of the way that Steinbrück and Harrell basically split their vote evenly, 15% each. If that had all gone to one candidate, you would have had a, you know, close to a three-way tie. The two candidates who won are the guys who had the best field operations, the guys who had did the aggressive phone banking and working, getting voters actually to the polls. One reason McGinnis people are fairly confident that he is going to continue to catch up a little bit with Murray and may even wind up in first place because of the ballot effort they did it all the way, you know, through Election Day. You know, they were phone banking in 5 or 6 different languages, mainly targeting Asian community and Hispanic community. So they think their numbers are going to do well. The battle now is not just for the people who voted in the primary for other candidates. It's a battle for all the people, you know, 75% of the people who, you know, or 80%, whatever, didn't vote at all and haven't tuned in, haven't made a decision. McGinn, I think I agree with Erica, you know, has a big job to turn around. You know, he got such a relatively, you're getting 30% for an incumbent is not a good number. He's got to turn a lot of people around. Murray's challenge is to get more people to know who he is.
Well, I thought Publicola had an interesting layout of what the two candidates needed to do. And were you at the Murray camp?
I was
party?
Not. No, Josh was, my colleague Josh Feiner.
And I was there.
You were there too. Everybody, Deb Wong from KUOW was there. And the report on Murray was that nobody seemed all that enthused when the winning numbers came up, that they were just kind of drinking their cocktails and going about, and that the speech that he gave was not going to be enough. At this point, we need to ramp up sort of his personal charisma politicking style to take on McGinn. Was that your impression?
Well, my impression was that the crowd was very enthusiastic. It was very large. It was at the Crocodile. The place was packed. What you saw in that crowd were a lot of fairly establishment people, former Mayor Royer, City Attorney Pete Holmes, Tim Burgess, who ran for mayor and dropped out on the city council. There were a lot of people standing behind him on stage. And I thought what they were trying to do, I think they were very confident they were going to be in the top two. I think what they were trying to do with that victory speech, and the McGinn and the Murray victory speeches were great contrasts, The Murray victory speech was an inauguration address. It was he was at the podium in his suit and tie, and he was reading his speech, sometimes a little awkwardly, and basically kind of trying to bring all Seattle together and covering a wide range of issues.
Now, one thing that came up in that I know, Erica, you've taken some flack about was that Murray was talking about women department heads in the McGinn administration.
Mm-hmm.
And Murray hasn't brought up a whole lot of issues during this campaign. So he brought up some issues. This was one of them. Tell me what you were taking flack about.
Well, I reported that the number of department heads or the number of cabinet level positions, if you compare, you know, apples to apples, the same positions at the same point in McGinn's predecessor, Greg Nichols' administration, was much greater. It was
There were more under
Nichols than there are under McGinn. There are 13 now. There were 13 as compared to 7. Now, the McGinn administration has pushed back on that, saying that his chief of staff should count as a department head or should count as a cabinet member, and that his chief spokeswoman should also count. And to me, you know, my response to that is that those are political appointees. So if that's, you know, if those are two people representing the public, then, you know, Rahm Emanuel represented the public, you know, Ari Fleischer represented the public. I mean, that's, you know, it's not to denigrate those positions at all, but I don't believe, and I wasn't counting them under Nichols. So just an apples to apples comparison, there are fewer women.
It's interesting to me, I'm sorry that you got attacked for your thing, but it'll be interesting to follow that. But I just find that issue to me sort of came out of, I'm not quite sure where, CR, you know where it came from.
Well, I don't, I think it came from America. I mean, did Murray
bring
it up?
Yeah, yes. I reported it
Murray
first, and then
yes.
Murray brought it up.
Yeah.
I think this is, I don't think this is particularly fair. I mean, if you want to compare Mike to Greg, I mean, Greg Nichols, I mean, his sort of deputy mayor chief of staff was, you know, a white guy for 8 years. So, I mean, McGinn has a African-American deputy mayor, a female chief of staff. You could say the second most important department, other than probably your deputy mayor, is your finance director. That was a white guy under Nichols, a woman under McGinn. I mean, I think this is a – I don't think this is going to be a winning issue for Murray. I mean, there's a lot of diversity in the McGinn administration, and I don't think that's a promising avenue for him.
And I agree that there is a lot of diversity, but – the biggest departments, you know, transportation, Seattle Center, I'm forgetting what the other two or three are, but the biggest departments under McGinn are headed by men. So, you know, you have these kind of, you know, traditionally, you know, like human services, neighborhoods, those are headed by women. But the largest departments are not.
Skip.
Well, there are just a couple of interesting things that it plays into. One is the gender inequality of pay of state workers, and the fact that one of the reasons is there's a very kind of top heavy male long time employee issue there. So there's a way that talking about that feeds into that a little bit. The other thing that he's very careful about is both playing up and playing down the fact that he is gay, and he's not running, and he made this a kind of explicit, I'm not running to be Seattle's first gay mayor, but the first thing I'm going to do after the primary is I'm getting married to my longtime partner, and they're an adorable couple. It's hard not to see that. So, and I think that he was also making a pitch. His whole pitch on election night is, you know, a city government that reflects the city itself. That's the diversity issue and the gender issue, and a city that's has a government as good as the city itself.
We're going to continue our conversation debriefing the recent primary election. I guess it's still ongoing. Nothing's been certified. With Knute Berger, the Moss back at Crosscut, Erica C. Barnett, news editor at Public Cola at Seattle Met, and C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's the height of summer when people flock to the outdoors to kick a ball or throw one or run a race or score a goal. Or so I've heard. I'm in public radio. I'm spending the summer rebagging my vintage comic books. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for an unusually active edition of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Join KUOW for Bumbershoot, featuring 3 days of art, comedy, and music at Seattle Center this Labor Day weekend, with artists of all genres from the band Fun to 60s rock with the Zombies. More on the events page at KUOW.org.
It's going to be sunny today with an afternoon high of 84, currently 71 degrees in Seattle. Tonight, some clouds, maybe a thunderstorm, and a low of 60. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1022.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. We're talking over, as we do every Friday, the news of the week with our roundtable of journalists. Erica Barnett, news editor at Publicola. C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Fox Q13. I guess it's Q13 Fox, right? And Knut Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com. And before we talk about where we're going to go in the general election with these two candidates, Marie and McGinn, I wanted to talk. Everything else was sort of calm, but there's a race in the Bellevue City Council. Not normally a hotbed of wild infighting, but it has been. The demographics of the East Side are changing. Knut, you covered the East Side for a long time, so I don't know if you have some particular insight into what's going on with this one city council race, which is at this point got one woman ahead of the incumbent and the other high-spending challenger just out-polling the incumbent.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, I think what's going on in Bellevue is Bellevue City Council used to be divided between the sort of downtown Kemper Freeman wing and the neighborhood NIMBYs. And the NIMBYs pretty much all got washed out. And now the fight is sort of between the downtown developer kind of Kemper Freeman wing, and they tend to be Republican. They tend to want a kind of car-centric city, and new blood on the council, which is very pro-density, pro-transit, that kind of thing. So that's where part of the struggle is. You have longtime city councilman Don Davidson running for re-election. He's been in ill health. He's been in for decades. He's been in a long, long time. And, you know, he came in third in the polling. He's a percentage point behind Vandana Slater. And she is, you know, a kind of self-funded candidate. And then Lynn Robinson came in with almost 50% of the vote.
Now, Vandana Slater, not just self-funded, but spent the most of any Bellevue City Council candidate for primary and general election ever.
In one go.
C.R., aren't you a Bellevue native?
I am a Bellevue native. And when I was in high school, Don Davidson was on the Seattle City Council. So this is how far back this guy goes. I mean, he's been there, as Knut says, for decades, since the early 80s. Bellevue has changed dramatically since Don Davidson was first elected. You know, what was a red town is now a blue town. And as Knut says, basically, you know, a lot of the people getting elected in not just the city council, but sort of, you know, the sort of local ledge districts there in the state, you know, they're pro-transit, they're pro-environment, that kind of stuff. So that is the growing demographic over there. This race is sort of about New Bellevue and Old Bellevue. Mm-hmm. And it looks like Old Bellevue lost. Wow. I mean, the two top vote getters, Robinson and Slatter, assuming nothing changes in the later counts, because Don Davis is behind by just a little bit. But they are both sort of progressive, represent that sort of Democrat shift in what Bellevue has become.
Now, Knut mentioned...
And that will, by the way, if one of those wins, it will tip the balance on the Bellevue Council.
One of the ongoing fights in Bellevue has been where they were going to put the mass transit line. I'm not actually sure.
Or whether they're going to put the mass transit.
You know, are we going to run it through the center of the city where people who want to go to Bellevue can use it? Or is it going to be over at Eastgate somewhere? And then I don't know actually how you were going to get to downtown. I mean, you might know.
And Don Davidson kind of represented a light rail opponent. You know,
just, we don't want
Kemper
it at
Freeman
all.
Wing. Yeah. So.
Well, yeah. And of course, Kemper Freeman, who is still a major civic and political presence in Bellevue, is against light rail, sued to keep it off the bridge. He's done, you know, whatever he could to block it. The interesting thing is there are really two Bellevues going on. One is this more conservative old guard, which has been control, you know, controlling the council for the most part. The other is what Bellevue has been doing at the zoning and planning level in terms of the Bell Red Corridor. What's interesting there was that they zoned that corridor to actually attract the light rail to it. They wanted, the planners wanted light rail going through that corridor, and they have a huge transformation plan there. And that's part of what this fight on the city council is about, because that transformation is going to require some significant public investment by people who live in the city.
So should Robinson or Slater win the, well, both of them, if they both come through, then... Sierra, what you're saying is that the balance now shifts to the transit
then
people.
The sort of Democrats, progressives, if you will have four votes on that council instead of just three.
I've been emailed three times, so I'm going to read this email. Somebody just did something, so I can't read my email. But former King County Council member Brian Jurdowski, who seems to be a very regular listener, wanted us to shout out to the mayor of Black Diamond race. A guy named Dave Gordon got 67% of the vote. The incumbent got 18%. The issue was the largest single development ever proposed in King County, which Dave Gordon opposes. What's at stake is nothing less than the entire Enumclaw Plateau's farm and rural land, writes Brian Jurdowski, a future freeway to Pierce County and the first use of tax increment financing in Washington State to subsidize a developer. The Court of Appeals is expected to make a ruling this fall on a challenge by citizens. So we will follow that. Just had a new producer take over, so that's exciting. I always like to see changes in personnel. Arwen Nix now at the helm. Any of you follow politics in outlying King County? No, not
much. I did want to say one other thing about the races on the east side, just quickly, is that you're seeing, and I think we're going to see even more racial diversity among candidates. And I think the Vandana Slatter race, she's of Indian descent, and she got a lot of support from the South Asian community. And in the Reagan Dunn race, Sherry Song, in that race, Korean American. And one of the most striking things, going back to what CR said about the way the East Side and Bellevue and Redmond in particular have changed, is in terms of diversity, right, and in terms of where those folks are coming from.
We're talking over the week's news with Knute Berger, C.R. Douglas, and Erica C. Barnett of Publicola. And let's bring it back to Seattle now. So we've got two candidates. This is it. There's two white men, speaking of diversity. We don't have that on that masthead. But we're going to see, I'm assuming, issues coming out as opposed to style in the general election, because we haven't seen a lot of issue mentioning from Ed Murray.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually going to continue to be about style. I'm kind of sad to say. Particularly if McGinn continues to push the narrative that he's been pushing, which is that this is a recreation of, you know, of 09. He's the outsider candidate. You know, he's the brawler. Murray's the establishment guy. You know, he's the not the more progressive candidate in the race. And I suppose that gets into issues a little bit. But, you know, it's basically Murray's going to argue that he's competent, calm, and capable of leading. And McGinn is going to argue that, you know, that he gets things done.
CR?
I think a couple dynamics are starting to become clear, which is, yes, the sort of McGinn side is going to paint Murray as, well, one thing they're going to do is put Olympia on trial. Mm-hmm. So his time in Olympia is going to be very much fair game. And you can start seeing another tact here, which is he's kind of conservative. He's more establishment. I mean, we just saw, and I'm sure they'll make hay of the fact that he endorsed Mark Sidran, you know, 10 years ago, Ed Murray did. So I think, you know, McGinn is going to stake out the left. He's going to stake out progressive, and as much as he can, try and keep Ed Murray out of that box. And on the Murray side, he's going to do what Erica says. I mean, this guy, you try and take him down by being divisive, by being ineffective. So it's going to be sort of divisive, ineffective versus, well, you weren't effective in Olympia, and you're also more conservative.
Yeah, I think Erica and CR are exactly right. You turn your opponent's strengths against him. So he's got the establishment support, so you turn him into Joe Malahan. He doesn't really know the city. He's got all these establishment people. He's their puppet, whatever. And then his other strength is his experience in Olympia. You turn that against him and say, well, did he really do such a great job for us in Olympia? And here's all the things he could have done that didn't happen, et cetera. So, you know, I think that's part of the race you're going to see.
You think it's going to be ugly?
Well, I suspect so. I mean, I was struck when I wrote my story about election night. There was a supporter of McGinn's who you know, grabbed the mayor and, you know, got right into his face and said, "Throw some punches, man." And I think, you know, I think they want the McGinn supporters like their feisty mayor. They like the outsider. They like the underdog, the scrapper, the guy who they saw the victory on election night as a, you know, hey, we came back. You know, we did what they said. Murray is running a completely different sort of campaign. I mean, I was really struck by the music that came on after he gave his victory speech was "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow." It's Clinton 1992 music. And I was like, wow, who chose that? I mean, I think there's almost a generational divide in terms of how they're pitching their messages.
They're about the same age, though.
Yeah, I don't think it's not a real generational divide.
I think it is going to get nasty. One reason why the primary wasn't nasty, there really were no hit pieces, so to speak of, by any of the candidates, is that that is not necessarily an effective primary strategy. You could put out a hit piece on McGinn, and you could sort of bring his numbers down. But then it's not obvious where those people, what of the other eight candidates will those people who now don't like McGinn vote for. So it's not an effective way to spend money. But in a general election, where when you bring down McGinn, the clear beneficiary is Ed Murray, you know, so you're going to see, just because we're down to two, more hit pieces. I think the other thing that's going on here is we clearly have, it's a new generation of independent expenditures, and you will have these independent groups that get in. They're already in what, almost a couple hundred thousand dollars just in the primary.
Yeah.
Well, if you combine the two,
yeah.
They will be in this big on both sides, sort of labor, if you will, on the McGinn side, and sort of business establishment on the Ed Murray side. And that typically is a sort of home for hit pieces. You know, the independents that don't have direct connection with the campaign can kind of say, hey, it wasn't us, it was someone else, not coordinated. That's going to draw some negativity.
Erica, do you think it's going to be as ugly as these two do?
I do, and I just want to ping off something Knut said, which is the idea that the representative for the 43rd district is not familiar with the city is pretty ludicrous. But I think that, you know, McGinn might be able to make it stick, you know, that he doesn't know the city, that he's the business guy, that he's Joe Malahan. What works against that, though, is the fact that Murray, much unlike Malahan, has an amazing ground game, just like McGinn. So the advantage McGinn had in 2009 is that he had an amazing ground game then too, and had his supporters phone banking right up to, you know, election minute. and he did that again this year, and he'll do it again in the general, but so will Murray. And
so that's what's different from 4 years
that's
ago.
It's very different from 4 years ago. And Murray is not Joe Malahan.
No. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's not Joe Malahan. And and of course, what McGinn has to overcome is, and when I was out with Peter Steinbrück at Whole Foods, when Peter was doing on a Monday, doing last minute campaigning out there, it was amazing to me how many people, they didn't say "we're for you, Peter," but they all said "anybody but McGinn." Anybody but McGinn. I mean, they're not all.
Well, wait,
of them,
because they're all Whole Foods shoppers and they're upset.
No, these were Amazon workers that were having lunch.
And this represents the biggest challenge for McGinn, which is he still has high negatives. It still is an uphill battle. I still believe he's kind of the underdog going into it with these two. The interesting thing will be, what do the Peter supporters do? What do the Bruce Harrell supporters do? I mean, there is now a race to gain those endorsements. And, you know, an endorsement can look like a lot of different things. It can be a full-on embrace, I'm tethered to you till the end, which is kind of what Tim Burgess is doing.
Right.
Or it can be, I send out a press release, you've got my vote, and then you'll never see me again, the campaign trail. So it'll be interesting to see if Bruce and Peter get on board and how loudly and enthusiastically they get on board and whether their supporters follow them.
You know, I actually asked that question yesterday, and I have not. I don't know if either of you have heard back from Peter, but.
Well, Peter told me he was going to take his time and he was going canoeing and camping. And he'd think about it while he was gone.
And Harold told me basically the same thing, that he hasn't made up his mind yet. But I see his supporters going to Murray. I mean, it's pretty hard to see Harold's supporters going to McGinn.
I would disagree with that a little bit. I mean, I think it's probably likely that Bruce Harrell will support Murray. I mean, he's been a real critic of the mayor. It seemed very unlikely that he would just turn around and support the mayor. But that doesn't mean all supporters are going to go that direction. I mean, Harrell had a big sort of vote in Southeast, in Beacon Hill. He really, you know, pushed his role as sort of a representative of communities of color, social service groups. I mean, a lot of those are kind of natural McGinn allies. So I think you can't just write off McGinn as not getting a Harrell vote or a Peter Steinberg vote just because they voted against the incumbent in the general. I think some of those votes are still up for grabs.
Was it Publicola? I think it was on your website, Erica, where you talked about how Murray had to distance himself from the chamber, from the business groups.
He does, but that's a McGinn created issue, and it's really a question, I think, of how effective McGinn is with sort of, you know, painting him as the chamber establishment candidate. And it's funny, they were using terms like downtown developers and terms that you really haven't heard, you know, from the McGinn crowd ever as pejoratives.
But some people might argue that Mike McGinn has closer ties to those developers, particularly in South Lake Union, which, CR, you've talked about on this show.
Yeah, I mean, it is ironic, but I do think this is going to be the dynamic, sort of push Ed into the establishment and, you know, I'm the most progressive mayor in America as the mantra for McGinn. But it's going to be a complicated story because Vulcan, I mean, there are a lot of people that have really liked McGinn. His pro-density agenda has benefited a lot of the establishment.
When he formed a pro-density group, Great City.
Right. Let me be the boring person here. What are the issues besides all this hyperbole that are at stake this fall? What are the substantive things that we're choosing between? Knut, do you have any idea?
Well, I've thought all along that one of the most substantive issues is kind of in some ways a colorless issue. It depends on how you talk about it. And Murray is one who addresses that, which is the making sure that all these mega projects actually work as they're designed. We have all these projects coming through, and they're all coming to a head within the term of the next mayor. It's amazing how much, you know, with the bridge and the mm-hmm. tunnel and all these things are kind of coming online in the same thing. Somebody has got to stand up for the city's interest, not the state's or anybody else, the city's interest, and make sure that stuff all integrates. I think both McGinn and Murray can make a claim to that. Murray talks about the integration issue explicitly. But I think that's one of a major issue in terms of what the mayor will actually do as opposed to the wedge issues that they bring up.
I just have, there's two squibs before you weigh in. One is that I found I read with great interest this morning that Chris Hansen was delinquent in the money that he owed the city for doing the EIS environmental impact statement pre-work for the arena, which is a project that might come online. He owed the city something like $75,000, if I'm not mistaken, which I thought was funny, he just said he was out of town. He didn't pay it. Also got an email from Mel and Ravenna.
I could do that with my rent.
Kate Martin wants to know if a write-in campaign should start for Peter Steinbrück. If this happened in a concerted fashion, he still might not win, but it would change the course of the election for one guy or another. And Marta says, I have to say I'm a Harrell supporter that will absolutely vote for Murray regardless of him being conservative. Anybody but McGinn. So this conservative tag.
Well, and I don't believe, I mean, Ed is not conservative in like how we think about this. So I'm not saying this is the charge McGinn is going to
make. Right.
But it's going to be, rebutted, very, I wouldn't, maybe easily, maybe not. I mean, this guy has a, 100% voting record for labor in the last legislative session. This is the champion of gay marriage. This is a guy that's got a progressive background. But that, interestingly enough, I believe McGinn is going to try and make it about issues. He's going to try and make it about progressive issues. And Ed is going to try and make it about competence.
We're going to continue this in just a minute. Going to take a quick break. C.R. Douglas of Q13 Fox News, Erica C. Barnett of Publicola, and Knute Berger of Crosscut.com here with me. I'm Marcy Silman on KUOW.
Mostly sunny and 70 degrees in Seattle, expecting to top out at 84 this afternoon.
This week on This American Life, a journalist is given a phone number to call, and when she does...
Hello?
Turns out the people on the other end of the phone are a group of hostages being held and tortured in a desert thousands of miles away.
And then he told me about their situation, that they were 29 to begin with, but that one had died.
And then... she tried to save them.
We'll find out what happened tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Sound Theater Company, presenting The Wild Party, a musical by Andrew Lippa based on a banned poem about a troupe of thrill-seeking burlesque performers in the 1920s. August 8th through the 25th at the Center Theater at the Armory. More at soundtheatercompany.org.
This is Weekday on KUOW, and on Fridays we talk over the week's news with our roundtable of journalists, and we are here with Knute Berger, C.R. Douglas, Erica C. Barnett. I'm Marcy Silman, and we were talking about the Seattle mayor's race, and I was kind of reading in this flurry of emails that we've gotten, and one was this idea of a concerted write-in campaign for Peter Steinbrück. Think that would have any impact? Who would it siphon votes from?
Well... I don't know who it would siphon votes from necessarily, but here's the interesting thing. Council members have a horrible track record about getting this job. I mean, Peter and Bruce obviously didn't make it through this primary. The sort of mayoral politics is littered with the gravesites of council members trying to get it. Jan Drago, Cheryl Chow, Charlie Chong, Jane Nolan. You would think it would be this great, and there were more. You would think this would be this great stepping
Sam
stone.
Smith, Phyllis Lamphere.
You'd think it would be this great stepping stone. You know, they're sort of involved in city government, and then they sort of move up. The only one in recent memory that's been able to do it is Norm Rice. I mean, he did go from the council to the mayor's office, but it's just not a route that works.
Interesting. What do you think?
I think, you know, I think a write-in campaign would be incredibly destructive and pointless. In terms of who's actually going to be mayor, but like CR, you know, I don't know who gets Peter's votes. I was talking to John Fox of the Seattle Displacement Coalition yesterday, and you know, he's basically one of the anyone but McGinn guys. But it's kind of hard to see, you know, that crowd and the crowd of people who, you know, generally supported Peter, the kind of old, the neighborhood folks, as flocking to Murray either.
We all want to jump just one thing on sort of where some people are going to go. Tim Harris, the real change guy who supported Peter, is now endorsing the mayor. So you do have people coming to McGinn from those other camps.
Nick says, I voted for Peter Steinbrück in the primary. I'm definitely supporting McGinn in the general. I had hoped that it would be a Steinbrück and McGinn general election because we would have had substantive discussion of important issues. Jerry says, I like Murray and McGinn equally. I think they would both make good mayors, but the Seattle Times has hated McGinn since day one, and that's why I am voting for him. So there you go. This is how we choose. These are you guys up who are emailing in probably all voted in the primary election. Do you want to talk?
Well, I just,
would you like to,
isn't that why I'm here?
Yes.
I noticed on election night that Murray was making kind of a clear play for both the Steinbrück and the Harrell voters with comments that he made about One Seattle, which is kind of a Harrell theme. But he was also talking about density, and this doesn't have to be a choice between neighborhoods and density. We can have both. So I think he was definitely positioning himself to be welcoming to those groups. But I think it's unpredictable when you get down to the issues of particularly of style and personality. Those things kind of transcend sometimes one's specific issues on things.
Before we move off the election theme, what would each of you most like to see as we head into November?
You mean in terms of...
Are you looking for blood on the track? Are you looking for smear campaigns? Are you looking for issues? What are you looking for?
You know, I'm going to be kind of milquetoast here and say, you know, I would love to see a substantive discussion of affordable housing in this race. I know, boring,
well, there's an
right?
issue I haven't even heard brought up at
all. It hasn't been. I mean, you know, and it's a huge issue right now in Seattle, and it's a huge issue in front of the council. It's a huge issue in front of the mayor. You know, how are we going to incentivize new affordable housing? How are we going to keep housing more, you know, as affordable as possible in the city? You know, and that kind of plays into the issue of density a little bit that Knut was mentioning. But, you know, I think that's... Murray's pitch there is really just kind of an attack on McGinn because he's seen as a density mayor. Mm-hmm. So I would love to see a discussion of affordable housing.
What about you?
I think absolutely. I think police is just going to be a huge issue. It'd be great to have a sort of substantive debate on, okay, reform's happening. We're under this consent decree. Who's really going to drive reform? Who's going to be the better leader of this going forward? Transit. What is the future of transit? What is the future of bus service? What is the future of rail, streetcars, that kind of stuff? I mean, that's come up a little bit, but, you know, laying out the kind of next generation of all that is very important.
So you want to hear about issues, both of you. Knut, what do you most want to hear?
Well, I mentioned the integration issue, the sort of transportation and integration issue, I think is important. And what I'd like not to hear is I'd like to not hear anything until after Labor Day.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the other very interesting story. There are a lot of stories this week, but Amazon founder Jeff Bezos laid out $250,000 of his, which somebody
quarter
told me.
Billion.
Quarter million.
Billion.
No, billion. Billion.
Quarter billion, $250 million. You're right. This is his, somebody told me that's like chump change for him, to buy a newspaper. Not just a newspaper, one of the newspapers in the country, the Washington Post. First of all, were you three surprised to hear that news?
I was incredibly surprised. I was surprised that the Post sold. I mean, here is a longtime owner, the Graham family, second and maybe even third generation of the Grahams involved in the paper. I mean, they built that thing from just a small kind of, you know, regional paper to a national paper. You know, printed the Pentagon Papers, all that kind of thing. That was sort of a family legacy, sort of sense that it was never going to leave the family. And then the surprise is the owner, Jeff Bezos. Here's the guy that's like, you know, created, you know, he's a digital, you know, pioneer. And he wants this relic of a print newspaper. It just, the sale seemed odd and the buy seemed odd.
But what about you, Erica?
I found it. I was totally stunned. And, you know, I mean, the Post kind of, the Graham family in particular, kind of personifies this idea of noblesse oblige, you know, mm-hmm. that you know, they would always kind of take care of their employees. And so the fact that they sold it all is super surprising. You know, I think the idea that Bezos can come in, and I assume that this is his idea, can come in and sort of save, you know, this relic, as you called it, you know, of the newspaper industry. Nobody's done it yet. You know, maybe he's smart enough, but it's a bigger problem than I think he possibly realizes.
All I could think of is that he's a really smart businessman, and boy, this doesn't seem like a great business investment. So there must be something else.
Well, that's everybody. I mean, one of the smart things about it is it gets everybody to relook at everything. One is that Bezos, who's not been particularly politically involved, he has given money to support gay marriage and Patty Murray, et cetera. Instantly, whatever he says now is going to be seen in the context of him having national influence. Whether or not he exerts editorial influence on the Post or not, it makes him a player in a political arena that he has not been in before. The other thing is that, and this goes to Erica's point, people in the newspaper business, by and large, are – I mean, the other big surprise was the price. I mean, I'm sure, you know – Frank Blethyn probably left a little something in his Pampers when he saw that price, because it is
low.
So low. These are media companies, and you saw this with the Boston Globe sale, mm-hmm. as well. Media mm-hmm. companies that have been worth in the billions of dollars, selling for penny, you know, pennies on the dollar, basically. partly because of exactly the problem that Erica pointed out, which is people don't know what to do. And I think what's interesting is that people know that Bezos is a really smart guy, love him or hate him. He's been an incredible innovator in terms of retail and in terms of technology. And to have somebody with that intensity and that focus and that interest, I think old guard newspaper people are going to be really uncomfortable with what happens, because they're going to be uncomfortable anyway. The world that they lived in is pretty much gone and going fast. So I think everybody in the newspaper industry is going to be watching this really closely, because it both sickens people on the one hand because they hate the loss, and it excites them on the other hand because a lot of them aren't seeing much of a future.
We're talking over the week's news. Knut Berger, Erica Barnett, and C.R. Douglas are here. And the other thing that really struck me about this was that we've seen a lot of media conglomerates taking over newspapers, but not so many individuals. And I wonder if that makes a difference at all. I mean, regardless of his ties with Amazon.
Well, I mean, I guess my reaction is that, as Erica said, it's this dying industry. You know, what they have $50 million of losses last year. I mean, it just seems like there's no end to the red ink. And actually, you know, Tribune is the company I work for. We actually just spun off the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune, you know, get rid of the newspapers and keep the television stations. And actually, the Washington Post owns some TV stations and some cable systems, and they are keeping those. So the only thing he's selling is this newspaper. So Bezos is buying this sort of dying thing. It again surprises me because of that. The difference perhaps is, you know, the Graham family doesn't have the resources to really put in a bunch of money to maybe save it, to maybe invent the future of journalism and kind of find that magic bullet that hasn't been found yet, as Erica points out. So that's the sort of advantage here for the Post and for journalism, is this guy's got such deep pockets that he'll be able to invest in it. In a way that actually, as a public company, it was a little bit harder to justify pouring a ton of money into it for the Graham family.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think also the fact that he is an individual means that, you know, potentially he will be personally more invested in it, not just literally invested, but personally, as opposed to one of these media conglomerates that, you know, CR said are spinning off their less profitable or their money losing properties.
Well, I think people have been rightly looking at who is Jeff Bezos, because I think any organization takes on the character of the ownership. If that ownership is corporate and Wall Street, they'll take on that character. If that is family, I'm buying this as an easy eleemosynary gesture, that will affect everything flows from the owner. Even if they don't have direct operations, everything will flow from that.
I can't help also thinking about the family-owned newspaper in this town as well when you talk about the Graham family.
Yeah, I mean, we have a local Graham family. It's the Blethyns.
Right.
And they've owned it for actually longer, you know, 100 years or over that, you know, longer than the Graham family, which was like 80 years. So, you know, Frank Blethyn was quoted as saying, you know, good for Bezos, but I'll never sell. So they're sticking to it. One other thing I would say, if I was an Amazon stockholder and I wasn't, I would not love this purchase. I mean, it's a personal purchase. It's not a corporate purchase of Amazon's. But the amount of time Jeff Bezos is now sort of like buying into with having to deal with all the headaches of this paper strikes me as, why do you want, you know, I don't want my corporate CEO, if I'm an Amazon stockholder, be fiddling around with that. You know, focus on the billion-dollar company that is Amazon.
Boy, you're really down on the newspaper industry today.
Do you think that Jeff Bezos has a lot of day-to-day running Amazon anymore?
Absolutely.
Well, then he can't possibly have time for both of these. Maybe he's going to choose. I mean, maybe journalism is alluring. At one point in time, it was an alluring and grand profession.
You know,
this
Ted Turner was able to run a cable network. I can't imagine the Washington Post is more complicated than mounting an America's Cup challenge. Billionaires are able to multitask. They're able to compartmentalize. I don't think this guy's going to have any problem.
They have help.
In fact, I think he'll have fun.
I just lastly, before we end, have to touch on a charming column, Knut, that you wrote about Ken Griffey Jr. Jr. is going to be inducted into the Mariners Hall of Fame. How big is that hall, by the way? Tomorrow evening. And you evoked the image of the 1995 win that saved baseball in Seattle, and the picture of Jr. under the pile of happy players as he slides into home with his big happy grin. That was a time where there was joy in Mudville.
Yeah. I said in that column that if Kurt Cobain represented the sort of dark side of Seattle and the dark part of our soul in some ways, Ken Griffey was exactly the opposite, the sort of light, boyish, playful nature. And, you know, I wrote that column before all the stuff with A-Rod came to a head, Alex Rodriguez. And now, you know, of course, a lot of people are pointing to this sort of contrast between two ex-Mariners and kind of what they've become in the public. And I think the thing about if you had kids in the 1990s, you know, the Mariners from when Ken Griffey joined the team on was just the best of what baseball could be. And, of course, if those fans had lived through the 80s, which was like the worst baseball could be. And I just think that the celebration of Ken Griffey, it's just you know, a lot of his fans are reaching the age when they're starting to get nostalgic about the, you know, people are just nostalgic about the 90s and what he represented to this town. I think it's a great thing.
Well, yes, and as you say, you wrote it before, what happened to Alex Rodriguez. Here's a guy who was the golden child when he arrived in Seattle, and it was a time where the Mariners were doing really well. And when he left for Texas, that was a bad thing. People called him Payrod. What do they call him now? I mean, I can't even imagine. They're booing him at every game.
I think those words are banned on the radio.
Yeah.
They probably are. But it's an interesting as lifelong guy here, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even a particular baseball fan. And I got caught up in that 95, you know, pennant race. And, you know, does it get better than Ken Griffey? I mean, who is more deserving of this Hall of Fame than he is?
I just want to point out that Mike McGinn's victory party was at a sports bar called 95 Slide, which is named after the play, the come from behind, you know, scoring play of Ken Griffey in the playoff series against the Yankees that year.
Any of you going to be there tomorrow night? No.
Nope.
No, but we'll talk to somebody who was next week on Weekday. Thanks, the three of you. I know you're looking forward to the post-Labor Day imminence and when you get to lick your chops and talk about politics all the time. Erica C. Barnett, news editor at Publicola at Seattle. Matt, always great to have you here.
Thank you.
C.R. Douglas is political analyst for Q13 Fox. Knut Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com. Katie Sewell produces our show with Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette, the man at the helm. I'm Marcy Silman. Join us Monday. Have a great weekend. This is 94.9 KUOW.
An update on the California wildfires in the news in a moment. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
On this week's On the Media, one Washington Post reporter describes the announcement that Amazon boss Jeff Bezos had bought his paper as being like a funeral.
But a funeral where you didn't know the person had died in the first place. Thank you for coming. Grandpa has just died.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Sunday night at 6 o'clock.
Join KUOW for Rainier Valley Culture Fest weekend, celebrating diversity and summer at the Rainier Valley Heritage Parade in Columbia City, Saturday, August 17th, and the Othello International Music and Arts Festival at Othello Park, Sunday, August 18th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Hear swing, jazz, and popular song from the golden age of radio on the Swing Years. I'm Amanda Wild, inviting you to tune in for the best music from the first half of the last century every Saturday night starting at 7 o'clock on 94.9 KUOW.
Is everybody having a good time? Of course you are.
73 degrees in Seattle and mostly sunny.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.